The Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 1059. It's Friday, the 4th of May, 2018. On the podcast today, I have... before I get to that, don't forget, we have a new podcast series out called Business Lives. You can see it at voxmarkets.co.uk/businesslives, and it features high-profile people in the world of business. All right, on today's podcast, I have Hanno Pingilly, Business Development Manager at Ncondesi Energy, that's NCCL, and Hanno provides an update on the project and explains what the £950,000 they've just raised will be used for. Also on the podcast, Merlin Mar Johnson, CEO of Eris Resources, E-R-I-S, and Merlin discusses their new Swedish gold project and gives a general update on other parts of the business. Plus, as it's a Friday, Russ Mould, Investment Director at stockbroker AJ Bell, talks about the following stocks: Redcentric, that's RCN, Nichols, N-I-C-L, and Morse's Club, M-C-L. We also have a brief discussion about active versus passive fund management. Plus, as always, I have the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Hanno Pingilly, Business Development Manager at Ncondesi Energy. That's NCCL. Hanno, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you've raised some funds, you've also done a project update, and we'll go into that in a bit. But as always, Hanno, there are people listening to the podcast or maybe not familiar with the company or new to the podcast. So for those people, please give a summary as to what Ncondesi Energy is all about, please.
Sure. So Ncondesi Energy is a coal-fired power plant project and integrated coal mine located in Mozambique, looking to develop a 300 megawatt power plant that will supply power into the Mozambican grid.
Mm-hmm. And at the moment, I mean, there's a lot of potential there, of course. At the moment, you are sub 20 million market cap, and of course, that's a huge generator. I think a $1 billion project, isn't it? So there's a lot of potential there. So let's go into the news, Hanno. So we'll go back firstly to the day before yesterday, sort of project update. So what is this all about? Take us through the significance of this and what's happening, please, if you could.
Yes, so we are in the process of negotiating a joint development agreement with two of the world's largest power utilities, General Electric and China Machinery Engineering Corp, or CMEC. Mm-hmm. The parties are looking at investing in to the project as potentially at the minimum of 60% equity holders in the project, and also bringing all of their development, construction, operational expertise to the project. And as part of that process, we are in a detailed due diligence phase at the moment. And a key step to that was updating of our integrated financial model to get to reconfirm that the project economics. And really critical to that process was receiving updated EPC and O&M information from our partners. And you know, EPC and O&M is power, you know, is a power term for basically the CapEx and the OpEx assumptions that go into your financial model, and then provide you with, you know, the project economics and crucially your target tariff envelope to deliver on those economics. And really, this is a major milestone for us because, you know, it basically, we've received the information over the course of the last 2 months. We've now been in a position to update the financial model, get a sense of how big the project is, what its returns look like, and what sort of tariff envelope we'd need to agree with the Mozambican government in order to deliver those returns. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we received that information just over 10 days ago. We've been able to turn it around very quickly internally to update our model. And, you know, the initial results from that model are positive in that not only are we getting the target results that we were after in terms of project returns, but very importantly, we've come with a more competitive offer in terms of what tariff we can go back to government with to finalize the power offtake agreement, which will be a 25-year offtake agreement. And that's been pretty crucial for us because it basically means we're going to go back to government with a more competitive bid than we previously had agreed with government. And, you know, that should, you know, that's very important in allowing us to drive the incentive with government to approve the project and move forward. And I must say, you know, so we're obviously very excited at this stage. I must highlight that, you know, we previously worked with another Chinese partner that we terminated discussions with about this time last year. And that was that followed a three-year process with that Chinese partner. And I'm really happy to say that where we've got to with GE and CMEC at this stage currently in the development process is further than we ever achieved with our previous partners. So, you know, we're more advanced than we've ever been to date. Results are looking good. And, you know, with everything going on in Mozambique, with tariff pressures that the region are experiencing, for us to come back with an even more competitive tariff is very exciting. The next phase, just to update everyone, is that we have now submitted that model to our partners, who are reviewing the results of that model. There'll probably be some more optimization discussions to see if we can further improve on certain things, and there'll probably be some Q&A sessions on the results as well. But the objective is to get sign-off from our partners on the results of the model, at which point we will then submit it to government to get support for the new tariff envelope. So in terms of timing, there's good regular news flow coming. We're hoping to have the financial model signed off during the month of May. We will then go to government during June, and then, you know, subject to getting all the necessary approvals from government to move ahead, we should then be in a solid position to finalize the joint development agreement with our partners in July. So lots of news flow, lots of work to do over the coming months. You know, very exciting period for us.
Yeah, well, you know, a project this sort of big and, you know, this complexity, it doesn't always run smoothly. And like you say, you've had a few hiccups, but now you seem very confident that this project is now at the most advanced stage it's ever been. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. And, you know, there's certainly a bit more confidence now in that, you know, we actually have some numbers from our partners that confirm that, you know, we can deliver the project as we had targeted. You know, it's one thing to do everything yourself and put everything together, but when, you know, you've got two fairly large players coming to the table and confirming that with their own numbers, you know, that definitely is a really positive position to be in, and a strong position to be in.
Yeah. And like I say, you know, when it's fully up and running, generating a lot of free cash flow, but at the moment you are pre-revenue, of course, you need to raise funds. You've just done that. You just raised, £950,000 before expenses through placing at 6.25 pence. Take us through the detail of this, if you could, Hanno.
Yes. So I think another thing to be excited about, I think a very successful placing completed this morning. It wasn't necessarily planned. This all happened fairly quickly with the momentum in the news flow, as well as, you know, we had some positive momentum in the share price. But key message here for this placing was that we managed to raise more money than we were expecting. We were oversubscribed. We have raised at a premium to our previous capital raise 6 months ago. I think it's a 25% premium to our previous capital raise. With strong demand from existing and new shareholders. In fact, as I say, the placing happened very quickly, closed out very quickly. And interesting fact, you know, I believe this is the highest priced capital raise we've made since our initial IPO back in 2010. So, you know, a nice positive little milestone there for the company that we're moving in the right direction. So, you know, very excited about it. It puts us in a position where, from a G&A perspective, we're covered for the next 12 months. That puts us in a very strong negotiating position with our partners as we look to finalize the JDA. Also demonstrates to our partners that we're able to raise capital when needed and pay our way when needed. I think that's very important when you start talking about funding in the future and demonstrating, you know, our ability to do things. And really, I think, you know, the big part of all of this is that we've managed to do this, as I say, quickly, at the right time. We're entering into the summer holidays where, you know, the markets wouldn't be open to us. And, you know, crucially, on the other side of the project, you know, where we're negotiating contracts and we're moving development programs forward with Chinese and American partners who are all based out here in Africa. You know, we have a very busy period over the summer, regardless of it being summer in Europe. So, you know, this just sort of takes some pressure off and allows us to focus on getting the JDA done. And, you know, we're, say we're well capitalized to do that now. And we're very excited about, you know, what we were able to achieve.
Yeah. And, you know, the share price has risen quite strongly in the last few days. So, you know, 16% discount isn't a huge amount, really. But you always get people, you know, whinging. I suppose they don't understand how the capital markets work for pre-revenue companies. Like I said, you know, it's, you know, your AIM is a high-risk, high-reward sector. You know, people, that's why people invest there. And, of course, when you're going for money, you know, it's largely their terms, isn't it? I mean, I assume. But can you take us through, the mechanics of how it sort of works? Because, like I said, the share price has risen strongly in the last few days, so there's going to be some discount. But you can't just name your terms, can you?
No, not always. And certainly, you know, I would say this is probably the most successful placing we've done in a long time in terms of, you know, the demand was there. You know, people expressed an interest in raising, you know, in putting more money into the company. I think people are aware of the fact that there's good momentum, mm-hmm. share price has appreciated. The dilutive impact of this raise is less than the last one. It sends a positive signal in terms of a new price floor for raising capital. And, you know, with regards to timing, as I say, you know, Inkondesi had indicated that it's only got capital until the end of August of this year, you know, prior to this fundraise. And, you know, as you can imagine, you know, as we, you know, we've obviously got a lot of positive news flow that we're planning over the next 3 months. But, you know, you can never plan, you can never have 100% certainty that everything's going to go to plan. And you never know what's going to be happening on the markets. So, you know, when the iron is hot and you can get a good price that's you know, value to shareholders and to the project, you know, you've got to strike while the iron's hot, and we did that, and, you know, we're very happy with the result.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, one more thing to do, Hanoi, and you know about this. If someone's listening to this and likes the sound of this and what you're doing, the progress you're making there on the project, but are not yet following the story, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Sure. So we are one of the most advanced coal-to-power projects, both in the region and on AIM. We have currently in negotiations with two highly credible, world-renowned power developers and operators who are looking to assist us in fully de-risking the project through construction, operation, as well as financing. And the project is likely to deliver very good returns. It's a $1 billion project. It will, you know, generating 300 megawatts. That will deliver, you know, cash flow. Well, I won't say cash flow because we're in negotiations at the moment. But, you know, we're looking at revenue streams between $250 and $300 million a year for the project. So a fairly significant project.
Yeah, absolutely. Hannah, good to chat to you. And hopefully we'll chat again in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Merlin Marr Johnson and CEO of Eris Resources. E-R-I-S is ticker there. Merlin, thanks for joining me.
Good morning.
And I understand you are busy, but you just better get busier because you've announced a new Swedish gold project. Before we go into the details about this and what you know about it, explain to people listening right now who's not familiar with Eris exactly where you're involved, what the business is all about, please, Merlin.
Eris Resources is an exploration company. We're listed on AIM. We joined at the end of 2017. We raised £4 million, and we've got a zinc portfolio in Ireland and a gold portfolio in Sweden. We've got strong industry partners with some Canadian mid-tier companies. We're a technically led team, and we're out there to make discoveries, and we're looking to make those discoveries in politically stable prospective jurisdictions, and we're very happy with Ireland and Sweden, and we've got a lot going on in 2018.
Yeah, what do you say at the moment is sort of the flagship project? I want to say program and project then, but which is the flagship project, you would say, Merlin?
Well, we're kind of split down the middle, really. It's kind of 50-50. We've got the Abbeytown Zinc Project in the northwest of Ireland, and that is a high-grade clean metallurgy, shallow project, very close to surface with all the right infrastructure. So that's 100% owned by us, and we are working hard on that. We're drilling that at the moment. The other half of the portfolio is that we've got a strategic alliance with Centerra Gold, which is a $2 billion Canadian company, on a series of license areas in three quarters of the way up Sweden on the Skellefteå mining district. Mm-hmm. And Centerra are funding that. And that's a slightly different approach. That's a portfolio approach. We've got multiple drill programs on multiple projects there. And so half our effort is there, and that's, we don't pay for that. We're funded for that. And then, but we've got lots of optionality. And then we've got our own project, which is the Abbeytown in Ireland.
Excellent stuff. Okay, well, let's go into the bit of news you've had out. New Swedish gold project in, is it Innäsen, number five, is that right?
Yes, Innäsen, absolutely. We've been granted a gold license or a kind of an exploration license around the Innäsen gold mine. It's a... We've done a review of the prospectivity of Sweden, and a few weeks ago we put out news that we'd been granted the Nordgruven project as well, and this is a similar thing, the Innäsen project. Interestingly, it's in an area of Sweden that's had very little exploration, and the old Innäsen mine was mined by Boliden from 1984 through to 1991, and it was a high-grade, clean gold deposit. And it's sitting on a major structure, on a gravity break, on a band of prospective geology. And there simply hasn't been a lot of work done in that area. So we've got a 50, but it's actually close to 60 square kilometer license around the old gold mine. And we're going to get in there, do some reconnaissance mapping and sampling to look for extensions to that mineralized system.
Yeah, and you see here, it produced 1.7 million tons at 3 grams per ton between those dates, 84 to 91, is that right?
Yeah, it was 3 grams a ton gold. There was a small amount of copper in it. In fact, there's a disseminated chalcopyrite gold stockwork. This is a metamorphosed high sulfidation deposit. So we know that these kinds of systems can be large. They are structurally controlled. They have decent alteration signatures. So we'll be looking for repeats of these along the trend.
Absolutely. And so just going, I mean, like I said, you are busy. You've got a lot of programs going on there. So what's the next sort of major milestone you're looking to achieve, Merlin?
In Sweden, the work program that's being funded by Centerra Gold, we're coming at the back end of the first drilling program of that. So we're waiting for results from the Klippan project, and we're gearing up for drilling at Tjärringberget and in particular Brandberg. So we've got these three drill programs funded by Centerra this year. And so we're preparing for the next drilling program during May. And we've got a rig booked for June, July, August to drill Tjärringberget and Brandberg. And Brandberg in particular, it's got 20 holes in already, and we can see continuity of mineralization. So we'll be targeting extensions along strike and along depth of that mineralizing system. So we're very much looking forward to that. But in terms of prior to that, we'll probably have the results back from the Klippan drilling, which should come out in May. And looking at Ireland, we've started drilling there in right at the end of February, kind of more or less March. And I don't know if you've been aware, but Ireland's had one of the worst winters in 70 years. And we're looking to, so we weren't able to drill actually on the main Abbeytown project itself. And we're looking to get the drill rigs on that soon and put out some results from the... we should be able to have some results from the regional exploration that we've been doing there. So that, again, also in May, so kind of an update on the Abbeytown exploration program.
Excellent stuff. Okay, well, if someone's listening to this and likes the diversity here and the amount of things you have going on, but they're not yet following the story, Merlin, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add you to their watch list, please.
The first reason is that we've got quality projects with proven mineralization and we're operating with a strong team in stable jurisdictions. It's a quality setup. The second is that we've got valuable industry partnerships with two mid-tier, $2 billion companies. Osisko Gold Royalties, who are a major shareholder, and Centerra Gold, who are our partner on the Skellefteå mining district areas. Mm-hmm. The third reason is that we've got multiple catalysts occurring during the course of 2018 off a very small market capitalization. So any successful drilling program, project generation should have an immediate impact on that share price and get it moving in the right direction.
Marvellous stuff. Merlin, good to chat to you and hopefully we'll be chatting again in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, Investment Director at stockbroker AJ Bell. You all right, Russ?
I'm very well, Justin. How are you?
Good, thanks. Yeah, I saw a picture of on Twitter. I think one of the guys, was it an event you sponsored or something? And I saw a picture, you said, right, let the battle commence. And it was two guys
was two of my colleagues. They were debating the pros and cons of passive funds versus actively managed funds.
What do you take from that? Were you there when they were doing this?
I listened to them do it twice, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, they just took questions from an audience of independent financial advisors, and so they were talking. You know, they were debating the pros and cons. And to be honest with you, the conclusion that people took away is that you don't need to get all philosophical or all religious about this. They can work together perfectly comfortably. The great thing is that you have choice. You know, I suspect that some asset classes are probably better suited to active, some asset classes are probably better suited to passive. I mean, the active guy said, look, there are just some markets, US big cap equities, for example, where you just aren't going to beat the market. It's just too well covered. It probably is just too well efficient. So don't even try. If you want US exposure, he's very happy to go with the passive. They're gilts right now. You know, yields are so low, you can't really justify employing an active manager necessarily with all the fees that come involved. So yeah, definitely, you know, by all means go passive. But equally, there are some areas, property, you know, physical property, for example, that just aren't suited to a passive, because if you own a passive, you just end up with REITs, which are equity. So you're taking on equity risk. You're not getting the diversification that you're expecting to get. So we think it's horses for courses. But yeah, clearly, the cost angle on passives is tremendously powerful, and it's keeping the active managers very, very honest. Mm-hmm. Equally, there is a select number of active managers who have consistent. They won't do it every year. But over time, they've consistently beaten the market in their particular area, and so it shows that it can be done. It isn't just luck. But equally, you've got to say there aren't millions of them, and there are too many active funds out there, equally which are just expensive, not providing value for money. Equally, the fact that you've now got more stock indices than you have individual stocks tells you that investment banks and Wall Street are jumping on the passive bandwagon, and there's probably, you know, one or two of those that shouldn't be around either. But I think over time, the passive ones will get smarter. You'll get more and more powerful algorithms, more and more smart ETFs that look at things like governance and do a much better sifting job than they do now, rather than just saying, oh, look, I'm going to, you know, track an index and I'm going to have 8% of my money in HSBC because that's what the index says. I don't think that's a particularly smart way of allocating your money either. But I think, you know, there are pros and cons for both. Cost from the passive side is so incredibly powerful. Costs can compound up just like dividends do. We all know that. And so in that respect, they are definitely a terrific part of anybody's portfolio. Should you go exclusively that way? Well, you can do. But the one thing that any investor must remember is that the majority of them are Delta One products. So they've been fantastic recently because they go up in line with the market. But don't forget, if the market goes down, they'll go down in line with the market as well, and you mustn't forget that they will just track it straight down. And certainly in the next bear market, which I'm sure will be with us at some stage in the future, that there, you know, active managers, in many ways, that's when they really earn their crust, because that's when they protect you on the downside.
Yeah. And you know what? It's I suppose it's like anything, really. I mean, if you haven't got the time and you don't, you're not an expert. You know, I live in the market. I love stock picking. I research all the time. But if you have like a full time job outside the market, then you want that kind of, I suppose, you know, someone to look after it for you. And,
There's no crime in admitting that you're too busy or you just don't know. If anything, a bigger crime is just guessing.
Because
then you're not investing, you're gambling. And we all know that gambling is very different from investing. You know, as you know, I love a bet on the horses, but I go into it as a bit of fun, and B, I know what the risk reward is, which is the risk is means you can make a multiple of your money, but the reward is you can make a multiple of your money on a horse, but clearly the risk is you instantly lose 100%.
Because
if the jockey falls off or the horse gets blocked in or the ground changes, the horse loses, you lose 100%. And investing is not about that sort of binary risk reward scenario. It's about protecting your downside first and then looking for the best risk-adjusted returns that suit your particular personal financial circumstances going forward. You know, we're talking generally about small caps here, so you are clearly taking above-average risk in search for what you hope will be above-average returns. But just because you're taking more risk doesn't guarantee you above-average returns. If it did guarantee you above-average returns, you wouldn't be taking above-average risk, would you?
Yeah, exactly. And I see it, you know, I mean, people often talk on the smaller caps about a punt. And I think, well, listen, I don't do punts on investing because to me, investing is about trying to put odds on that you gain money.
Correct.
Whereas gambling is odds against, you know, and, trying to do enough research to bring it in your favour rather than just having a 50-50 or less chance of getting your money back, you know. And
correct.
Anyway, talking about stocks, Russ, let's get on to some specifics. So what are we looking at?
We're just going to do three updates this week because all things that we've looked at relatively recently, and there's been news on all three of them, Redcentric, Nichols and Morse's Club.
Okay, cool. Redcentric. Take us through
it. I know we looked at it a couple of weeks ago. Harrogate-based. It's RCN AIM, and it's an IT communications and outsourcing provider for small and medium enterprises and also some public sector now, generally via the cloud. So it's helping these smaller firms get their systems together in as cost-effective a way as possible. Now, lots of people will hear the company's name and cringe. Late 2016, accounting irregularities were unearthed. There's still an investigation ongoing by the FCA. And in the end, it turned out the company was overstating the value of its assets and understating the value of its debt. So the people
Bad
responsible
combo.
For that, not a good combination. So the share prices, you can understand, got taken out to the woodshed. The management team were cleared out. You've got a new management team in now, and they're making all the right noises. Let's focus on cash flow, not profit. I know it sounds mad to people who don't look at the market all the time, but there's a massive difference between the two. Let's focus on paying down the debt, and let's focus on building some recurring revenue through a subscription model, so we've got much better revenue visibility than we've got now. There was a trading statement that we discussed about a few weeks ago, which was incredibly bland, trading in line, full stop. But what it also did say was that net debt has come down again from 39 to 33 and now to 28 million. And lower debt means lower risk. And that goes back to where we started this conversation. Because, you know, if a company's got lots of debt and not much profit, the clock's ticking, because in the end, the bondholders or the banks are going to want their money back. And so, you know, if you've got loads of cash, they're happy to fund you. If you haven't, then you've obviously got a big problem if you can't pay the interest or return the principal. So debt is coming down, which is good news. And now the company, just late April, announced a really juicy public sector framework contract from Yorkshire and Humberside, connecting 65 different organizations over 3,000 sites. So for a company that's clearly had some reputational issues, there is no way that a company or even a public sector body or a company will entrust a company with a 3 to 4 year contract if they think it's in financial difficulty. You just aren't going to do it, are you? Yeah. So the fact that we've got this big framework reference project, probably 1 to 3 million of revenues initially, but building to maybe 15 to 20 over time, potentially. So this is a big vote of confidence. Obviously now the company mustn't cock it up. You know, and let's face it, it's going to be a complex deal connecting 65 organizations over 3,000 sites. But for a company with £100 million of annual sales, to pull in a deal that might at some stage come in at 15 to 20 million is a very big deal. It's a reaffirmation of what the company can do, and also it's a show of faith in the fact that your management team are getting all the old accounting problems out of the way, and they're getting the balance sheet back into decent shape. So when we first looked at this stock, it went from 90p to 75p almost straight away, and you're thinking, oh no, what have I done here? But it's now bounced back to 92p, and if you look at the chart, Justin, I know what you're going to say, it's right up against the key resistance point right now, and I know nothing about charts, but I'd imagine that's what you're going to say. Is that fair?
Yeah, do you know what? So often with technical analysis or looking at charts, it's about round figures, you know? And since they dropped off a cliff back in November of 2016, it's traded between 80 and £1, you know, 100 pennies. So if it makes a move and closes above that, you know, pound level, you could say probably it's broken that range. Yep. So
let's see what happens. But so far, so good at least.
Cool. Okay, what's next, Russ?
Nichols, Newton the Willows, NICL, also AIM quoted, bigger company. Redcentric is about 140 million. This is a 560 million cap stock. And again, it's one that, you know, we've tried to catch the falling knife, you could argue, at a profit warning in December. It's a fizzy drinks company. Vinto, Feel Good are probably its biggest brands. Clearly, people have been worrying about the sugar tax and the impact of the levy that was introduced came into force in April. But its big problem was actually a profit warning caused by warfare in the Middle East. He was actually selling an awful lot of stuff into the Yemen, which obviously isn't a very easy place to do business right now. And that business has dwindled right away. So the share price went from £19 to £14 in pretty much an instant. Mm-hmm. The good news is they've had a statement since that says things haven't got worse in the Middle East. And now we've had an AGM statement saying that actually we're growing faster than the overall UK market, up around 2.5% in the first quarter. And yet, hands up, Middle East is still extremely weak, particularly because of the Yemen. So it looks as if for this year, you're going to have not much more than sales up low single digits, profits up low single digits. There's a 2.5% dividend yield there. But don't forget, this is a company with a 20% plus operating margin, net cash, generates cash. It's got a good record of dividend growth. You know, the one niggle is it's not the world's cheapest stock at around 20, 21 times earnings. But that's what you're going to have to pay for a business with this sort of profile. So let's see. I mean, I think it's one of those that's just going to slowly bubble away, if you'll pardon the expression, chuck out plenty of cash and dividends. And and now they don't need the Middle Eastern business to come back. The UK is performing fine. All of its drinks are sugar tax, are clearer on the sugar tax. It's doing good business in Africa. So it's just one to wait patiently. But again, I think you're going to tell me that the chart, it just needs to make a little bit more. It needs to bounce off the lows maybe once or twice more just to reassure you that everything's okay.
Yeah, we know that. 14 quid level is quite nice. Yeah. But again, 16 is a resistance, so it needs to get above that. It's below the 200-day
average. It's banging in the middle at the minute, about 15, 10. Yeah.
Talking about sugar, I highly recommend you watch that programme by Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall.
He's a good lad. I haven't seen the new one, actually, but I've got quite a few of his cookbooks. I'm a big fan. So.
Yeah, well, listen, he's only done two episodes, so it's easy to catch up on the BBC, but it's called Britain Fighting Fat, I think, but it's two of his issues is two of the big, you know, cereal makers in this country, Nestle and Kellogg's, do not put traffic lights on the boxes. Everyone else does. Home brands do. They don't put a colour one. They put a monochrome sort of. It's hard to tell at a glance. Secondly, he talked about sugar, and he went to Bristol and he sort of set up a little stall and he asked people to guess how much teaspoons of sugar in certain drinks, and he put Coca-Cola up there and he put that next to sort of on one side all the fizzy pop and the other side was all the smoothies and fruit juices, and turns out, you know, there's like small bottles of orange juice that you get, say, from McDonald's or that kind of size, 250 ml, you know? They have 8 teaspoons of sugar in, same as a full-fat Coke.
Ouch.
Exactly the same. They said you should be only drinking half that amount for a daily recommended amount, but because you've got, you know, say 6 oranges in that, that's not, you shouldn't eat 6 oranges in a day, because that's all sugars in there. So they're saying, you know, it's promoted as healthy and it's not. And so I was surprised by that. 8 teaspoons. You would never put that in a normal, you know, you imagine manually putting that in a drink. You would never put 8 teaspoons in a drink yourself, would you? But it's
not a problem.
I know a guy at work used to do that. He was working at a radio station. So 8 teaspoons of sugar in his tea is ridiculous. But I thought that's insane. Last stock, what are we looking at, Russ?
Morse's Club. Perversely, another northern company, Wakefield on this occasion. MCL, quoted. And it's the UK's second biggest doorstep lender and provider of credit to those people who don't necessarily have good credit scores, but perhaps do need short-term cash flow to help them through. You know, so its only biggest competitor is Provident Financial, which, as we know, has had a very, very difficult time with trying to change its model and how its agents work. And that company's been through a tempestuous period, which, you know, may now be coming to an end, given that it's raised cash from Neil Woodford and Mark Barnett at Woodford Capital and Invesco Perpetual, respectively. So it may be on an even keel. But, you know, a lot of the agents who were dissatisfied at Provident when the model changed, they've all rocked up at Morse's Club. So Morse is potentially in quite a sweet spot. And also, you know, we do know that for a lot of people, unfortunately, times are still not easy, and they do need access to perhaps some short-term cash flow. So Morse's is potentially in a good position. Full-year results came out in late April, following up what the March trading statement said. All good. Revenues up 17%. Credit up 21%. Customers added, they added about 6,000 customers, so just under 230,000. Earnings per share rose 8%, and the dividend was nudged up a little bit as well. And they've added agents aggressively, helped by the dissatisfied ones at Provident Financial. The one thing to watch here is clearly, it's all very well growing your loan book and lending the money. Does it actually come back? Because you are dealing with people who are obviously in potentially financially tight situation. The impairment ratio did go up 24.4% to 26.1%. So we do need to keep a very close eye on that, not just from a Morse's Club perspective, but you could also say from a wider UK economic perspective. If those impairment charges start rising sharply, then you know that an awful lot of people are unfortunately in a lot of trouble, and that's probably a bad sign for the UK economy overall. But at the moment, at least, everything's going according to plan. It's a stock on 10 times earnings with about a 5.5% yield. It seems to be in quite a, you know, you say almost unfortunately in a sweet spot, but it's there to help a lot of people. And right now, it seems to be going okay. And the numbers of just the stock, I think we first looked at it back in late March, at about 135, 136. It just dribbled down to 130, but now it's just broken back above 150. I mean, it only floated in 2016, and this is basically as high as it's ever been. So again, we'll see what the chart tells us from here. It may have a bit of a pause after a run, but if it busts through 155, I'm sure you, as the chart expert, tell me things might be getting a bit more interesting.
Yeah, do you know what? Sorry, because you mentioned impairment. I found it very interesting that the level of the percentage of impairment.
It's quite high, isn't it?
Yeah, 26% compared to 24.4, 26.1. And more as a judge of the overall economy, and I suppose you're right there. If people are really struggling to pay back their thing, I mean, is that a precursor to a downturn, you know?
I would say it would be. I mean, in the end, I know that Bank of England Governor Mark Carney pointed out at the start of the week that UK credit growth is just slowing down a little bit to about 8.5%. Mm-hmm. I guess in some ways you'd hope that's because people are getting some decent pay rises, which will obviously be the good way of looking at it. Equally, you could say, well, maybe it's just because they're maxed out and, you know, there's nowhere else for them to go on the credit cards, you know, so you can spin that two ways. So we'll have to keep a very, very close eye on that. But if you do start to see loan impairments go up, or even, you know, even just loans that are delinquent, you know, rather than being repaid back in 30 days, they're being paid back in 60 or 90 or whatever, that is often a sign that people are starting to find life pretty tricky. I mean, you're actually seeing loan delinquencies in the US on automobiles rise very, very sharply. You've got lots of Americans have all gone for these PCP style plans, where you actually don't own the machine, you lease the thing, and so, you know, there's a lot of people actually just finding even the lease payments tricky. So at some stage they might just be handing the keys back, and there's going to be an awful lot of second-hand cars floating about, which is something that we need to be very, very wary of. But yeah, let's keep an eye on that loan impairment number, because if it starts to go up, I'd be inclined to think it means that people are unfortunately in some difficulty.
Yeah, just quickly look at the chart. On the 1st of September 2017, this closed at a high pretty much at 153. Mm. And it's taken all these months to get back up there.
Yeah, it's just tickling it now, isn't it?
Literally, yeah, tickling it. And so you could say, it's, you know, it could be a double top here. And if it fails to get above that,
we'll
go back
find
down.
Out, yeah.
But if it breaks this, obviously it's just going to go higher. But it literally is retesting that high from September. So we'll see. Russ, thanks for that. And have a nice
enjoy the long weekend. Yeah, and you.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are as follows. At 5, Mobile Streams, MOS. At 4, I just spoke to Hanno, Ncontesi Energy, NCCL. At 3, Photonstar LED Group, that's PSL. At 2, Totally, TLY. And number one most followed company on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours is Bahamas Petroleum, BPC. Okay, here are the top 5 most popular RNSs in the last 24 hours released by companies. Number 5 is Velocys, VLS. Velocys sells a license to Red Rock Biofuels. At 4, Coro Energy, that's C-O-R-O, Holdings and Company. At 3, Ncontesi Energy, placing to raise £950,000. I spoke to Hanno about that. At 2, Vesarion, change of nominated advisor and broker. And number 1 is from Zenith Energy, ZEN, issue of CEO's salary sacrifice shares. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Have a nice bank holiday weekend, if you've got a bit of time, why not check out Business Lives, our new podcast, which is voxmarkets.co.uk/businesslives, where we talk to high-profile guests in the world of business. Quite inspirational, hopefully. Have a nice weekend. Much appreciate.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hear the intriguing stories behind some of the world's best love songs in the FT's Life of a Song podcast. From soul to funk, to punk to jazz. Discover how classic songs like Smells Like Teen Spirit, Yesterday, and Stairway to Heaven were born. Search online or listen at ft.com/podcasts. Plus, don't miss the new Life of a Song book, featuring a compilation of 50 songs that have appeared in FT weekend columns. Pick up your copy from Amazon, your local bookshop, or give a gift to someone who'd enjoy this brilliant literary mixtape.